Welcome to the third episode of Indestructible, Latin America with Rodrigo Acuña. This podcast is a collaborative effort between myself and Alborada, an independent voice on Latin American politics, media, and culture. I am a contributing editor of Alborada, and we are continuing to receive a lot of positive feedback on this podcast. The transcripts of the first two episodes are now available to the public, while I recommend you see the program notes if you are interested in supporting us on Patreon. For this month's episode, I had the pleasure of speaking to Mariela Cohen, who is a senior international officer at the Trades Union Congress, TUC, in the United Kingdom. The TUC Trade Union Federation represents over 5.6 million workers in England and Wales. Mariela is also the vice chair for Justice for Colombia, a UK-based organization that promotes human and labor rights. Prior to the historic 2016 peace agreement between the Colombian state and the guerrilla group Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC-EP, Mariela worked as an advisor to the FARC during the negotiations and after the signing of the November 2016 agreement. As we discuss in further detail in the interview, until the 2016 peace agreement, Colombia witnessed a major civil war between the state, dominated by the liberal and conservative parties, and numerous left-wing guerrilla organizations, of which the FARC was by far the largest. Established in 1964, the FARC, unlike Colombia's other leftist rebel movements, originated in the countryside from poor farmers who were expelled from their lands by large landowners looking to illegally expand their properties. What the FARC lacked in sophisticated political propaganda or major presence in Colombia's urban centers, it made up for in the countryside as an experienced and well-armed fighting movement who at one point controlled significant parts of the country. After the terrorist attacks in the United States on September 11, 2001, both Washington and Bogota labeled the FARC a terrorist organization. The FARC's taxation of poor farmers, who grew coca leaves used in the production of cocaine, also earned them the title of narco-guerrillas, despite the fact that Colombia's drug cartels and right-wing paramilitaries continued to have by far the largest presence in the drug trade and closest ties to the country's political establishment. In 2021, nearly 5 years since the peace accord was signed, hundreds of ex-rebels, along with social leaders, have been murdered, placing the peace agreement in serious danger. Worse, the mainstream international media appears to be providing almost no coverage of these developments. These issues, as with others, were discussed with Mariela. I now leave you with episode 3 of Indestructible. So let me start off by the first question. So Mariela, to start off with, I'm interested in knowing a little about your background. How did you become interested in Latin American politics? And specifically, how did you come to work with Justice for Colombia, where you ended up as the director of that organization?
So my family's Latin American. So I've got family in Argentina and Colombia. And I became interested probably in my late teens and traveling in Latin America. And then during university, I got really involved in kind of solidarity campaigns with Cuba, with Colombia, different issues. There were some exiled Colombian trade unionists that I met and just learned more and more about the situation and started just doing kind of activism around the issue. Went to Colombia on a kind of solidarity visit where you see the situation and started working with Colombians in London who were doing work around the issues. And then, yeah, just knew Justice for Colombia when it started and went to the founding conference beginning of 2003 when I was still a student. And then I started working there, yeah, the beginning of 2005.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so as we know, Colombia has a long history of political instability from the assassination of the progressive liberal politician Jorge Eliezer Gaitán in 1948, which sparked off the Bogotazo, a period of unrest known as La Violencia, from approximately 1948 to 1958. And in 1964, the peasant-based leftist rebel army known as the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC, were created and went to war with the Colombian state until they signed a peace agreement in 2016. At the height of their powers, experts have stated that the FARC had perhaps between 19,000 to 24,000 well-armed guerrilla fighters, while controlling significant parts of the country. For people that are unfamiliar with Colombia's history, what information would you share with them, and what do you think are the deep roots of the deep roots and the causes of the violence?
I think fundamentally the cause of the conflict in Colombia is inequality, whether it's, you know, material inequality, but also political inequality. So there's been this huge concentration of land ownership in the hands of a few, you know, and this dispossession of land of millions of campesinos, of peasant farmers, small peasant farmers. And violence has been used to do that. So, you know, paramilitary structures have often been used to displace people off their land. There's huge levels of poverty. And on top of that, you have a complete lack of space for political opposition. So every time the left has tried to organize itself, either politically or but also socially, you know, so community groups, trade unions, they're met with repression and with violence. And that's been historically, you know, the response to attempts for democratic opposition. So I think those two issues, the inequality in terms of the land and the issues around a lack of political space, are the origins of the conflict. And then on top of that, you've had, you know, some very grave military responses to civil society organization. You've had counterinsurgency operations, you know, with US support that have treated people as enemies of the state. Have targeted the civilian population. So all of that, I think, gives a bit of a flavour of what the conflict's about in Colombia.
Okay. So returning to your own story, you eventually became involved in the negotiations between the Colombian state, at the time governed by the conservative administration of Juan Manuel Santos, and the FARC. While negotiations commenced near the border between Colombia and Venezuela in 2011, eventually moving to Cuba, then Norway, and then permanently back to Havana, Cuba, at what part did you become involved in this process, and what were your main concerns?
Mm-hmm. So I think Justice for Colombia always had as part of its, you know, agenda to support a negotiated solution to the conflict, and to support, you know, the creation of peace with social justice. So we've always supported efforts for peace. And back in, you know, 2007, 2008, we were supporting efforts from Colombian peace leaders to create the conditions for peace talks, namely the release of hostages, and to try and create conditions for talks. I began to take Colombian activists and leading peace figures to Northern Ireland back in 2009, and then more towards, you know, 2010 and 11, to try and share experiences of peace, a peace process which is altogether different context, but there's experiences there that are valuable. When the public phase of the Colombian talks were launched, as you say, in Oslo in 2012, we felt it was really important. And we knew that the Colombian government was looking at Northern Ireland as an experience. We thought it was really important that the FARC and civil society had access to those same experiences. And we also thought it was important that the international support that was given to the Northern Ireland process was given in the same way to the Colombian process, but everything seemed geared towards supporting just, you know, the Colombian government rather than the process itself, and giving FARC, you know, access to the international community. So we took a group, I put together a group of people that had been involved in the Good Friday negotiations, Sinn Féin, DUP, former military, former, you know, Republicans, and we took them to Colombia to coincide with the beginning of the talks in 2012, November. They met with Santos, they met with the government negotiating team. We had them address the Senate and the House of Representatives. And it was very powerful to have people that had been, you know, on opposing sides of a conflict together saying, you know, highlighting the importance of the peace negotiations. But we were always very clear that it couldn't just be that they met the government and not the FARC. So at that time, obviously, the FARC was still on the terrorist list in the EU. There was not access to them in Havana. It was very much, you know, the government kind of wanting them to be there kind of quietly without interaction. But we took this similar group of DUP, Sinn Féin, SDLP and Ulster Unionist in May 2013 to meet the FARC negotiators in Havana. And it was the first public international delegation to meet the FARC during that process. And I think it was quite significant, especially that the DUP and, you know, the Unionists took part in that. And then from then, we just kept organising exchanges. And as I said, the aim was to give, you know, equality to an equal footing to the sides of the table, to push for a ceasefire, to push for more international support for the process. Also, we took the Northern Ireland delegation to Washington to lobby there and, you know, do a bit, obviously very different circumstances, but compare a little bit the US support for Ireland compared to Colombia. And then we also started bringing in experiences from South Africa. So I organized delegations of people involved in some of the process in South Africa to Havana. That was all as Justice for Colombia. Then in 2016, the process, the talks were at the point of talking about the UN involvement in the peace process implementation. The UN was asked to put together a verification mission to observe the disarmament of the FARC and then some of the elements to monitor some of the elements of the implementation. And I was asked to become an advisor to the FARC on the whole issue of international verification of, mm-hmm. of the implementation. Sorry, it's a bit wordy. But essentially, obviously at that point, the FARC themselves couldn't travel to the US. They're still on the terrorist list, which they still are on in the US. And the Norwegians and the Cubans, who were the guarantors, you know, also thought it was important that the FARC had communication with the UN, the Security Council, which was going to oversee the mission. So I was asked, I was contracted by the Norwegian government as an advisor to the FARC on the Chapter 6 of the agreement, which was all about international verification, not just the UN, but other international institutions that were involved. So I became involved, yeah, advising on that area of the negotiations, and I started traveling to New York regularly to be the kind of liaison and speak to members of the Security Council and make sure that they were hearing the kind of FARC's perspective. And then once they signed the agreement, I was in Bogota advising what became the negotiating table, became the kind of implementation committee where all the legislation was negotiated on, where everything to do with, you know, how to implement the agreement was negotiated. So I was the person liaising with the UN mission, with the EU, with the Security Council. Okay. Does that make sense? It's a bit hard to explain quickly, but yeah.
Yes, no, that's and absolutely fascinating. I'm just wondering, during the negotiations between the two parties, what aspects were the largest challenges and which ones were more easily resolved?
I don't think anything was easily resolved. I think, you know, the nature of the conflict, the nature of having, you know, two sides coming from such different perspectives and with such different aims of the peace process, I think, you know, the government, I think, approached it initially as a kind of negotiated demobilization, whereas the FARC, you know, wanted a very expansive agenda with, you know, a lot of things in it. I think there were issues around the process of the talks itself, which, you know, around transparency, around having civil society involvement, around having a bilateral ceasefire in place. There were, you know, a lot of issues around it that I think made it more difficult. And there was this huge opposition to the peace process while it was happening from Uribe, the former president, and, you know, this kind of far-right camp in Colombia. So all of that made it difficult. I think the chapter on victims and transitional justice was particularly difficult, probably the most difficult. And, you know, the question of the political participation of the FARC, you know, and the link to justice and their political participation, but also how broad is, you know, the justice in terms of, is it punitive? Is it restorative? Does it cover all the actors? So that, I think that was one, obviously I wasn't involved in that side of the negotiation, but I think that was a huge challenge. Yeah.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the conflict in Northern Ireland previously, mm-hmm. and I mean, they were obviously aware of that process. You were obviously aware of that process. So could you just maybe just touch on that aspect a little bit? And I'm fascinated by the fact that you've said that the FARC still remain on the terrorist list with the United States, given the fact that they are now a legitimate political party within Colombia.
So the Northern Ireland process, I think there was a lot of inspiration taken from some elements of that. People that were involved in the Good Friday Agreement from, the British government side were advising the Colombian government during the process. And we thought it was important, and I thought it was important that they, hear some of those aspects around prisoners, for example. So we took delegations of former Republican prisoners out to Havana to share the experiences of, the prisoners transitioning into civil society once the releases were happening, some of the challenges, also issues around the implementation of the agreement itself, which, a lot of the issues that we then saw in Colombia once the agreement was signed were things that were raised by people that we took out there in terms of interpreting the agreement into legislation and the process of changing, what was agreed when you're actually putting it into law. And then I think, obviously there was, I think the challenges in Colombia were enormous in terms of scale, in terms of having this huge rural, guerrilla army to transition into civilian life, the violence. Obviously, there's no comparison in terms of, the violence post-agreement in terms of the targeting of former combatants who've been killed since they signed. But I think there were a lot of things that were useful for them to hear. And as I said, South Africa as well, we took members of that had been involved in the constitutional process in South Africa and the new constitution, and also some legal people that were involved, issues around the Truth Commission and around paramilitary structures. So some of those examples were really interesting for the FARC to hear from. And then also there was a really interesting part of the peace process in Colombia was the establishment of a gender sub-commission, which had negotiators from both sides and really trying to embed an equalities focus throughout the agreement. So around women, LGBT rights, there was also similar attempts to make sure there was kind of respect of indigenous and Afro-Colombian rights. So we also participated in taking women, like former combatants from Ireland, from South Africa, and there were others from Guatemala and other countries, sharing the specific challenges that face women when they're transitioning into civil society. So that was also another thing that I think was important for the FARC to hear.
In 2012, The Guardian, I think in a rare improvement of their often poor coverage of Latin America, published an article by Peter Beaumont giving credit to Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez and Colombia's former leader Fidel Castro for their roles in the negotiations. What was your impression of the willingness of these governments to facilitate talks between the warring parties?
So Venezuela was involved in the early stages, and I have to say I personally didn't, deal with the Venezuelan government on this stuff. Obviously, the Cubans I got to know very well as they were hosting the talks, and Cuba and Norway provided this really important role of guarantors. So they weren't mediators, but they, sat at the negotiating table, they supported when there were issues. And the Cubans have played a huge role, in providing support for that process. I think what's been really distressing to see is how the fact that the Cubans have supported peace and efforts for peace has been used against them to put them back on the US list of state sponsors of terrorism. So they were hosting their talks with the ELN as well, in more recent years. Those talks between the ELN, the smaller guerrilla group in Colombia, and the Colombian government broke down after the ELN put a bomb in a police academy in Bogota. And in the event of a breakdown of talks, there was protocols that were signed by the governments that were supporting the process on how the ELN commanders would go back to Colombia safely. It's a kind of fundamental guarantee for in the event of breakdown of talks. And the Colombian government, demanded that the Cubans just return these people without respecting the protocols. The Cubans haven't. And so that's been one of the reasons why, you know, they've been accused of supporting terrorism, which is just outrageous, really. And it's also really dangerous, you know, besides what it does to Cuba, I think it's also a very dangerous precedent for peace processes. So it's been quite difficult with this Colombian administration, you know, that kind of breakdown. But I think Cuba and Norway, you know, both countries need to be really commended for the huge efforts they've made and the support they've given, financial, political, diplomatic.
Okay. Just to clarify for our listeners, the ELN is a smaller guerrilla army, which has also been at war with the Colombian state. And until recent, there were, I think, an attempt of negotiations between the Colombian state. It's just an explanation for our listeners. Now let's talk about the United States of America and their role in Colombia and the Civil War. As we know, the U.S. government long supported a military solution to the conflict. Writing in the Washington Post in 2016, Nick Miroff said, and I quote, "After 16 years and $10 billion, the once controversial security aid package is celebrated today by many Republicans and Democrats in Congress as one of the top U.S. foreign policy achievements of the 21st century. Colombia, a fast-growing nation of 50 million, has become the leading U.S. ally in South America and a major free trade partner," end quote. What is your view of the role of the United States has played in the conflict? And were you or any parties involved in the negotiations concerned about Washington's position regarding the peace talks?
Well, in terms of the view of their role in the conflict, obviously they have, you know, historic responsibility in the conflict. I think it's obviously important that the US supported the efforts for peace, given that role and given their interference and interest in, you know, south of the border. I think under Obama, there was, you know, support for Colombian government's efforts for those negotiations. That was reflected, you know, there was a US envoy to the peace process, like there was an EU envoy, Bernie Aronson, who, you know, was seen as someone who was very supportive of the peace process. There were issues in the sense, you know, there's a leading FARC member still in prison in the US that obviously FARC had hoped would be released, and he wasn't, and it wasn't, you know, on the agenda of the peace process. I think since Duque, the far-right Colombian president, came to power from, you know, a party that opposed the peace process, and then you had the convergence with, you know, Trump coming into power, there was a marked, you know, shift in the kind of attitude towards Colombia. You know, there was the return to really pressuring on the coca issue, to the Colombian government, you know, announcing that they may return to fumigations of coca crops, when in the peace agreement there's a very clear roadmap of how to deal with the coca issue and trying to resolve it in a way that actually gives peasant farmers an alternative and doesn't criminalize it. I think with Biden, although, you know, obviously a lot of the involvement in the conflict was under Democrats in terms of Plan Colombia, etc., I think the truth is, you know, Biden had Santos at his inauguration. He's already the US, you know, has been coming out with some statements around the peace process, around supporting the implementation. In the Security Council session last week, they even mentioned, you know, the killings of leaders and of former combatants. So I think there is hope that the new administration will support more vocally, you know, well, they haven't ever said they don't support the peace process, but hopefully, you know, there'll be more pressure behind the scenes or on the Colombian government to implement it. And I think it doesn't help that Duque's administration was so closely aligned to Trump. You know, the ambassador in the US was very, you know, supportive of Trump supporters in Florida. So all of that, you know, is at play. But I do think that the regional dynamics have a huge impact. You know, obviously the relationship with Venezuela, the very tense relationship between Colombia and Venezuela, all of that has an impact and hopefully doesn't eventually impact, you know, on the support for the peace process. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. In 2013, the National Center of Historical Memory released one of the most extensive studies into the conflict in Colombia. It claimed that the cost of lives since 1958 stood at 200,000, while 200,000 people, while over 5.7 million Colombians had been displaced due to the conflict. Finally, the report documented 1,982 massacres between 1980 and 2012, attributing 1,666 to paramilitaries, 343 to the rebels, and 295 to government security forces and unknown groups. While this study highlights that the majority of the massacres in Colombia have been committed by paramilitary groups who are known to be connected to the military, the drug cartels, and large landowners, was there any concern within the ranks of the FARC about they themselves being held accountable for human rights abuses?
So obviously I can't speak for the FARC. You know, I was working as an advisor in the process. And as I said, I wasn't involved in the negotiations around that issue. But I think one of the key concerns has been about the justice process not being linked to blocking political participation of the FARC. You know, the FARC were very clear they wanted to get involved in politics. They wanted to become a legal political party. So I think that was, you know, a huge concern. And that was something that was on the other, you know, extreme with the kind of Uribe camp always pushing for the FARC not to be able to be involved in politics post-agreement. So I think that was an issue. I think the FARC have been very clear, and the vast majority of them, you know, have stayed in the process and have been very clearly committed to taking part in the truth and justice process that has been established in the peace agreement. And I've got to say, I think it's, you know, one of the most innovative and groundbreaking mechanisms that's been designed in the peace agreement, because it's based on truth, it's based on justice, reparations, and non-repetition. But it's also, it's the whole model is restorative justice, you know, putting victims at the heart of the mechanism, but also it's not a punitive regime, you know, so it's not about just prison time. It's about offering the truth. It's about like restorative justice for the victims. And I think, you know, a lot of the opposition from some of the more kind of extreme reactionary forces in Colombia that hide behind accusations of, you know, this giving impunity to the FARC, giving impunity for the FARC's crimes. I think it's more about, you know, concern about the truth being exposed about some of their links and some of the other atrocities that have happened in Colombia. So I think, you know, what's important is the agreement gives victims equal footing. You know, for a long time in Colombia, the kind of disinformation and propaganda war was about just showing one victimizer. And I think the state and the paramilitaries, but also very often not just the material authors, but the intellectual authors, you know, business, the state agents, politicians, people that have, you know, been behind some of these atrocities against civil society. The aim was to try and have a process that encapsulated, you know, everyone who's been implicated in the process. So I think, you know, it's been an important process, and many victims have supported that mechanism, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, in June 2016, the Santos government and the FARC signed historic agreements on the end of the conflict, including a bilateral ceasefire, cessation of hostilities, and to surrender weapons. While the final agreement was submitted to popular ratification in a plebiscite in October that same year, it failed with 50.2% of the population voting against it. Following the referendum, both parties signed a revised version of the agreement in November. For our audience, could you explain some of these developments and maybe why you think Colombians failed to ratify the original agreement?
I remember that night really well, because I was back in London that night and watching the results, you know, coming in, and I was due to fly to Havana the following morning, and I arrived in Havana the next day just to this, you know, deathly atmosphere. It was really, really sad, and it was following, you know, the signing of the first version in Cartagena, where there was, you know, a lot of hope and excitement. So it was devastating. And I think, you know, the developments around it, as I said before, there was this huge hostility to the process throughout the talks from the former president and his supporters. There was a huge disinformation campaign around what was really happening, what was being negotiated. And I do think the Santos administration has responsibility in that, in the sense that they were so kind of insistent that things were kept very, you know, secretive. And actually, I think more transparency about what was being talked about would have helped quell some of that disinformation. I think also the government wasn't, you know, brave enough in defending the process. And I understand they were up against huge, you know, opposition, but I think it was important for them to be less complacent about the referendum and actually realize the extent of the risk of that referendum going the wrong way. A lot of the disinformation was about the issue we just talked about, around impunity, around what the benefits were going to be for the FARC, and, you know, positioning the peace agreement as if it was just about benefiting the FARC. The reality is the peace agreement is, you know, a tiny part of it is about the FARC. Really, it's about trying to address the causes, trying to, you know, bring some change, to open up democracy, to give, you know, people more access to political participation. As I said, you know, infrastructure and investment in the countryside, dealing with the land issues. So there was a lot of disinformation. And also another issue I already mentioned around the gender subcommission, that was also another point of attack. Elements, you know, some church figures and far right figures, you know, really attacked the equalities element of the agreement, which might seem astounding to international, you know, audience, because around the world it was being celebrated as this incredible thing for a peace agreement to have a women's, you know, and a gender equality focus. But it was attacked as, you know, pandering to the kind of most reactionary parts of Colombian society on the basis that it was going to promote homosexuality, that it was destroying the, you know, the family, all these kind of, that it was implementing, forcing gender ideology on people, and really, you know, twisting what this was about. So I think all of that combined, you know, in a very polarized society, and already coming from a conflict where, you know, disinformation and propaganda was used, you know, in the conflict. So I think the level of, I think there needed to be a lot more, you know, peace pedagogy, in the sense of during the process, you know, information, educational workshops, materials, you know, being given to Colombian civil society about what the peace and agreement meant, and getting buy-in from civil society. You know, it was important, I think, and could have been done more. Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I do remember reading some time ago that approximately over 60% of the FARC's ranks were women. It was a significant amount.
It was less, I think between 30 and 40%.
Okay, yeah. So 30 and 40%, but it's still a noticeable amount of women for numerous reasons joined their ranks. To bring the story forward to the current era, in 2020, some 200 leaders, social leaders, were murdered in Colombia, while some 77 ex-guerrillas were also killed. Since the signing of the 2016 peace accord between the Colombian state and the FARC, 251 ex-rebels have been murdered. During the decade of the 1980s, the FARC did enter into a less formal agreement with the Colombian state, which was meant to allow the Patriotic Union, a FARC allied political party, to participate in the country's electoral system. Towards the end of the 1980s, some 3,000 members of the Unión Patriótica, a Patriotic Union, including two presidential candidates, were murdered by right-wing death squads. Is Colombia again witnessing the establishment and its right-wing allies walk away from a peace agreement, while ex-rebels, social and trade union leaders are allowed to be killed en masse with impunity? What do you think are the prospects Colombia sees a return to war?
So I think It's been so painful and awful to see, you know, that happening. Just 2 weeks ago, a friend's brother, who's a trade union activist, was murdered. You know, it's constant, it's relentless. And I think the figures now, I think some are saying that, you know, it's over 1,000 social leaders killed since the signing of the agreement. So it's, you know, huge number of people and people committed to the peace process, community leaders, trade unionists, environmental activists, human rights defenders. And there has been, you know, a historic impunity in Colombia for the killing of these types of activists. And I think when people are brought to justice, often it's the material authors rather than the intellectual authors. And again, you know, you come back to the peace agreement, there's a whole section of it dedicated to how to deal with this issue and security guarantees, which just needs to be implemented comprehensively. You know, the state needs to have a presence, not just militarily, but also, you know, a presence in the regions that the FARC left. The vacuum was taken up by, you know, different armed groups. The illicit economies haven't been, you know, dealt with. So, you know, a lot of the leaders killed are also leaders that are promoting the coca crop substitution program. And I think this administration has, you know, downplayed the killings of leaders, the repression of the state security forces itself. I think, you know, there are clear mechanisms that could be implemented, and there needs to be more international pressure. That, you know, people say, isn't it terrible? But you don't see I think if it was in a different type of country, the media reaction internationally and the international pressure would be huge, and it needs to be at that level. It's completely disproportionately, you know, not covered in the way it should be. If you think of, you know, Ireland, or, you know, where you have so many people signed up to the peace agreement being killed afterwards, imagine the outrage. And as you said, you know, it's over 2,250 FARC combatants. These are people that signed up to the agreement in good faith, gave their weapons into the UN. You know, it needs to be kind of given the importance that it has. And I think it's really difficult because it can't be normalized. You know, it's just become a daily occurrence, and it's relentless. And sometimes it's just like watching this awful thing happen. I think Colombia, like in terms of the return to war, I think there's a fundamental, I'm not saying you do this, but I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding in terms of, you know, the fact that the absence of the FARC doesn't mean the presence of peace. Like the FARC disarming shouldn't be the ultimate kind of aim of a peace process. And there's a lot more to do before you can say there's real peace in Colombia. There's other armed groups, there's the negotiations with the ELN that should be taken up, there's paramilitary groups, you know, there's all sorts of things taking place in the really complicated regional dynamics. So I think that is an error to, you know, to look at it as if the FARC disarming now, you know, that's the only thing that needs to happen. And when you look at the peace agreement, the chapters that deal with the causes are the ones that are least implemented. So the political participation and the land chapter, they're the least implemented. I think there's a long way to go. Obviously, you have to recognize, you know, the lack of combat between the FARC and the state, the amount of lives that have also been saved without that particular, you know, conflict taking place. And I also have hope that, you know, the peace agreement is a roadmap, and the Colombian government, as much as they might not recognize it, it wasn't the Santos administration that signed peace. It was the Colombian state, and they have international obligations and, you know, constitutional obligations. The agreement's become an official document of the UN. It's, you know, there's a responsibility to implement that regardless of your political persuasion. So, you know, hopefully in the future there will be a more, you know, pro-peace administration. And I think that agreement, you know, it's about opening up the space for democracy and for a progressive opposition to be able to eventually implement, you know, the structural changes that Colombia needs.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I completely agree with you. I really think it's remarkable the amount of media, the global media silence in terms of the not covering the amount of killings that are currently taking place by, I think, quite clearly one particular side. of the conflict against another. So I think that's really interesting, and I think it places the process in serious danger. Finally, Mariela, would you mind telling our audience a little about your current work as a senior international officer at the Trade Union Council and as the vice chair for the organization Justice for Colombia?
Sure. The Trade Union Congress, I started just almost 2 years ago there. It's the Trade Union Center for England and Wales. There's over 5.5 million members. So my role on international, that we have a team, there's various issues that the team covers around, obviously international relations between trade unions, issues around international development, trade, business and human rights, supply chains, and responding really to policy that's been adopted by the trade union movement and all our affiliates. There's, I think, that internationalist kind of tradition in the trade union movement to support and show solidarity with trade unionists around the world. So we have a whole strand of work around solidarity work, and we've given priority really to countries where workers' rights and human rights and trade union rights are being fundamentally attacked. So Colombia is a priority country because it sadly remains the country where most trade unions in the world are murdered. We also do work on Turkey, we're on Palestine, on Brazil, and many other countries as well, building our relationship with trade union sisters and brothers and trying to build political pressure. I think another key kind of thematic area of work that I'm focusing a lot on at the moment is around the growth of the far right internationally. And you see that convergence of where the far right are growing, where they're in power, and, workers' rights also suffering. So it makes sense as a movement to be focusing on that both domestically and internationally. And the far right kind of is internationalist, isn't it, in terms of its links. So we're trying to build strategies around a trade union response to that, building, experience sharing with unions around the world and sister organizations about how they're confronting the growth of the far right in communities and workplaces, and obviously in electoral politics as well. So our priorities also cover that work. In terms of Colombia, I remain, my heart is 100% still there. I'm in touch with comrades daily in Colombia, and it's personal, it's friends, it's a lot of years of being very involved. I'm the vice chair now of Justice for Colombia, so I still work really closely with them, with Hassan, who's now the director, and trying to see where the TUC can add value. I mean, Justice for Colombia is a trade union campaign. It was created, and owned, belongs to the union movement. So we support, JFC. At the moment, we're working a bit on the fact that, there's a trade agreement that's been rolled over after Brexit from the EU, and just the outrageous fact that there's a trade agreement with Colombia without any noise about, what's happening on the ground and their obligations around the peace process. So I'm working really closely with Justice for Colombia, and obviously I'm still very involved in trying to support the peace process and all our brave, really, sisters and brothers there that are trying to work in such difficult circumstances. So,
fantastic. Mariela Cohen, a former advisor to the peace process in Colombia and a senior international officer at the Trade Union Council and vice chair for the organization Justice for Colombia. Mariela, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and thank you for this very interesting conversation and very valuable information.
Thanks, Rodrigo. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That concludes the third episode of Indestructible. Once again, I would like to thank Alborada for this opportunity to host Indestructible and would encourage our listeners to support this podcast on Patreon. You can do this for as little as the price of one cup of coffee a month. My sincere thanks, as always, goes to Alborada's founder and co-editor, Pablo Navarrete, who produces this podcast. If you have any feedback on this episode, I would recommend you write to us on our email, which you will find on the website. Soon we will return with episode 4, but until then, Goodbye and stay safe.